This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The UN Human Rights Office is appealing for $253 million to pay for projects to stop growing xenophobia, racial and religious discrimination, and other violations from spreading around the world.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up also. Britain's envoy for the Horn of Africa says immediate humanitarian action is needed to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of people in Somalia. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the former top UN envoy for Somalia is warning that unless immediate action is taken, hundreds of thousands of people in Somalia may die or be near death by May. Nicholas Kay is now Britain's envoy for the Horn of Africa. He says his country is deeply concerned by the famine warning in Somalia and that Britain is organizing a conference on Somalia. The Associated Press quotes Kay as saying, action must be taken before the May conference in London. The Famine Early Warning Systems Network warned this month that 3 million people in Somalia face crisis as well as emergency acute food security. Somalia, like many countries in Africa, is facing drought that follows poor and erratic rainfall last year due to the El Niño weather event. Parts of Somalia fell into famine in 2010 and 2011, mainly because aid could not reach those in need due to insecurity. Thousands reportedly died. The UN is warning that aid agencies have just 18 months to deal with the humanitarian crisis caused by the Boko Haram insurgency. Otherwise, it says, the consequences will be felt for years to come. The AFP reports that the humanitarian coordinator for Nigeria, Edward Kalon, says there is a very short window of opportunity. The insurgency, which began in 2009, has left at least 20,000 dead and displaced millions of people in Nigeria and neighboring countries. Norway is hosting an aid conference next week to deal with the crisis that's affected Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Famine-like conditions are reported in some of the makeshift camps for the displaced. The Human Rights Office is appealing for $253 million to pay for projects to stop xenophobia, racial and religious discrimination from spreading around the world. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
$253 million may sound like a lot of money, and the appeal is the most ambitious ever launched by the UN Human Rights Office. But this money represents only 3% of the overall UN budget. Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says the sum requested is only a pittance, considering human rights is one of the three pillars of the United Nations, along with peace and security. She tells VOA, the world is in a perilous state and the situation of human rights globally is dire. She says conflicts have always existed, but that what is new and worrisome is the erosion of human rights values, laws, and principles that were put together after World War II.
There were human rights laws and principles that we took for granted, that states voluntarily signed on to, that are now being questioned, that are being reopened, and in some cases that are being overturned. This is really the worrying part of the state of the world's human rights today.
The agency's appeal comes at a time of great financial uncertainty. The United States has been the largest donor to the United Nations, as well as the OHCHR. The Trump administration, however, has indicated that it may cut funding to the UN. Shamdasani agrees this is of potential concern, but notes the United States has played a leadership role since the days of the League of Nations, and her office is counting on that role continuing.
Of course, recently there have been some alarming rhetoric and even some alarming steps that have been taken that appear to be causing an erosion of these values. However, at the same time, we've seen quite an inspirational groundswell of defense of human rights.
Shamdasani says the appeal will support hard-hitting investigations into rights violations committed in places such as Bangladesh, South Sudan, and Syria. She says money will be used to train government, judicial, and political officials about human rights principles. This, she adds, will help alleviate some of the suffering of thousands of people victimized by torture, arbitrary arrests, disappearances, and other abuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The budget minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo has cast doubt on whether his country will be able to pay for elections this year. His statement has sparked concern as delaying the polls last year led to violent unrest. William Klaus has more from Kinshasa.
DRC Budget Minister Pierre Kangudia gave reporters the news on Wednesday.
1,8 milliard avec le budget que nous avons cette année.
He said it will not be possible to disperse $1.8 billion from this year's budget to organize elections in 2017. That hardly comes as a surprise. Total government spending for 2017 is expected to be around $5.2 billion, according to the most recent budget submitted to the National Assembly, which has yet to approve a public spending plan for this year. The budget minister's words, however, have angered the opposition. A deal signed on New Year's Eve with the ruling alliance stipulates that some of the nationwide polls postponed from last year should take place in late 2017, including the presidential election. VOA spoke to Deli Sasanga, a signatory of the agreement from the opposition. He said the minister's declaration demonstrates the government is going down a path completely different to that of organizing elections. He says the government must leave to be replaced by a responsible one capable of taking the country to elections. The president of the Electoral Commission, known as CENI, cited the $1.8 billion figure in early December when he presented the budget to cover the electoral process. That includes compiling a completely new voter list, an initiative launched last August, as well as holding presidential, parliamentary and local polls in this vast and poorly connected country. Delaying last year's elections has allowed President Joseph Kabila to stay in office beyond his constitutional two-term limit. The opposition says that was, and remains, Kabila's intention. But the DRC budget minister said that while the government is unable to deliver $1.8 billion to the CENI, that does not mean there will not be elections this year. The New Year's Eve agreement urges the government to mobilise resources both internally and from the international community. But there is another hurdle. The deal also calls for the installation of a new national unity government led by a prime minister from the opposition. 6 weeks later, that has not happened. The details still have not been sorted out. On Thursday, the African Union, European Union, United Nations, and International Organization of the Francophonie released a joint statement expressing concern about the delay and calling on the signatories to redouble their efforts for DRC elections. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Migrants continue to make the perilous sea journey from Libya to Italy, and many have died along the way. The European Border Control Agency, Frontex, says migrant deaths reached record levels in 2016. The official figure for last year was nearly 4,600, but the actual number is probably much higher because of many unreported boat tragedies. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following these and other developments regarding the migrant flows to Europe. From Rome, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Well, this is a report, a risk analysis by Frontex, and they not only noted that migrant deaths have risen to a record level on the Mediterranean, but they're very concerned that the numbers this year, people ready to leave Libya for Italy, could be as high as last year, and that would be around 180,000 migrants in 2017. Frontex is not only concerned about the migrant deaths, the organisation says that smugglers may even be bringing about disasters and mass drownings because the rescue boats are so close to shore. They're pushing people out offshore, assuming that they're going to be rescued and not really caring if they are or they're not.
What is Frontex trying to do about this?
Well, Frontex has been working with individual governments to try and not only send more rescue ships close to Libya, but trying to support the Libyan Coast Guard so that it can do more of the work monitoring its own coastline. The Frontex report says smugglers have become more reckless and more bold in what they're doing and really pushing these boats right out there where they believe that the rescue boats are going to intercept. And the dangerous crossings on these overloaded vessels have been organised well in advance and are continuing to happen, as we know, through the winter months. And it seems that the search and rescue operations may unintentionally be helping these criminals to achieve their objectives and continue to run very successful criminal businesses by taking advantage of those migrants.
Now let's move on to another aspect of the migrant story. We hear that some mayors in southern Italy are not putting out the welcome mat for these migrants. Is that right?
That's right. Two towns in the Basilicata region, south of Naples, have tried to stop migrants from being located in their towns. One mayor of a town called Cepaloni said he would not accept migrants under any circumstances. Raffaele Scarinzi, the mayor of another town called Vitulano, has ordered bags of sand to be dumped in the streets to block any new arrivals from coming to his town. He says that he's currently housing 30 migrants and he doesn't want any more because he says there are not enough facilities. Even seen some complaints in Lombardy, the area surrounding Milan, because the Italian government is trying to distribute more migrants across the country, and that area is complaining that it's already hosting more than 20,000 migrants in that region. So it's still a very big issue in Italy. It's going to become more of a political issue, particularly because the economy is very weak, unemployment is very high, and people are very threatened by the influx of migrants that we're seeing.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. 18 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has grown to be one of the world's largest donors to health programs and development. It has provided billions of dollars for various projects, more than many countries. As a result, it has influenced global health policies. In part one of her interview, VOA's Lenord Moudou spoke with Melinda Gates about progress made in recent years in improving health and reducing poverty.
Well, the progress is really astounding, and it's the progress that the world has made. And so it makes me even more optimistic about what we can do in the future, because not only has this progress been made about lives saved, about people lifted out of poverty, but it's accelerating now, particularly in the last 5 years. So there is so much more that can be done.
And one of the examples is the number of childhood deaths per year has been cut in half, according to the United Nations, since 1990, and 122 million have been saved. These numbers are really, really encouraging.
They are absolutely encouraging. The great thing now is we have even more data. We know what has saved those children's lives. It's been predominantly malarial bed nets and vaccines, but we're seeing the number of children's deaths go down, and we're also seeing that, okay, the deaths that are still left are particularly these newborn lives, these first 30 days. A million kids die on the first day of life. And so we also know now, okay, this is where we also need to act.
So how do we act to save these newborns?
We get more data. And so one of the things that we point out in the annual letter is that parents in Africa are letting us actually do now very thoughtfully these minimally invasive autopsies, and it allows them to understand what did their child actually die from, and then they let us use that information and that data so that we can understand what lots of kids die from and then put great tools behind that. And that's actually really exciting.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has played an important role in global development and improving health. What did it take to achieve this gain in children's health in particular? I know you touched on it. You gave us a sense of what it took. But if you could elaborate a little more from the foundation's perspective.
Sure. Well, first of all the work that we do is with partners all over the world. There's nothing we do without a partner being involved. And the other great thing is that the United Nations set before these Millennium Development Goals, they're now the Sustainable Development Goals, but it gave a roadmap, a blueprint to the world of how should we tackle death and disability around the world. And so one of the things that the foundation focused on with our many partners was on these childhood deaths. And a lot of new vaccines came out, particularly around pneumonia deaths and diarrheal deaths. Those are the two biggest killers of children still around the world. We needed new vaccines that didn't exist for those. Those vaccines now not only exist, but they're being delivered all over the world in some of the most remote rural places in Kenya and India and Tanzania. Parents are accepting them. The vaccination rate is up to 86% now around the world. We need to get that, honestly, to 100%, but parents are seeing the benefit of that. And parents are also choosing to get a malarial bed net because governments are now giving them out all over Africa. And they're not only getting them, they're actually sleeping under them because they see the benefits for themselves and their children of fewer malarial episodes in their households.
And you mentioned vaccine. Would you elaborate on how investing in childhood immunization is not just good for the child's health, but also beneficial to the economy? Because that's something that a lot of people are really struggling with to understand.
Sure. If a child grows up healthy, then they have their greatest potential of being educated and going on to get a job and producing economic means for their own family. And ultimately, if they lift up their family, they're lifting up their community and they're lifting up a whole economy. So we call that the demographic dividend. That is, if you get a healthy population of kids that get educated and then get into their productive working years late in their teenage years, literally, you see gains in your economy overall, but they have to start healthy in life, which is why vaccines are so important, why getting fewer malarial episodes is important, why getting the right nutrition is important so that they can grow and reach the potential they have, both cognitively and developmentally.
You talked about the demographic dividend. It was on the agenda actually recently during the Africa Union Summit. It is really something that seems to attract a lot of attention these days. Why do you think it is so?
I think it's attracting attention because we're seeing that countries who have lifted themselves out of poverty, countries that have moved all over the world from low-income to middle-income countries and ultimately high-income countries, certain steps in progress had to happen. One of those steps is that the children have to grow up healthy. Another step is that the children's births have to be spaced. Women have to be able to space the births of their children. Ideally, if they can space them 3 years, then those children have a better chance of a start in life. The children grow up healthier and the mom is healthier. And that means if the mom's healthier, she can bring in more income to feed the kids. She can get her kids in school. Moms and dads are very interested in getting their kids educated so they can participate and bring in income for the family.
That's Melinda Gates. You can hear part two of Leonard Moudou's interview tomorrow. Experts meeting in Harare have ended the three-day meeting on the army worm invasion that's destroying crops in at least 7 African countries. 16 East and Southern African countries have agreed on urgent plans of action to manage crop pests as well as avian flu. In a statement, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization said participants agreed that the fall army worm infestation shows the urgent need for swift and coordinated action to deal with such threats. They identified gaps in the region's early warning systems, response preparedness, and contingency planning. A new study by the Rights and Resources Institute reveals the main cause of land conflict in Africa can be found in competition for natural resources. The Institute is a global coalition advocating for forest land and resource rights of indigenous people. VOA's Kim Lewis reports from Washington.
The research was released at a recent event in Dakar, Senegal, that included leaders of three national land commissions from Kenya, Liberia, and Senegal. Also on hand were government officials, local community leaders, indigenous peoples organizations, and investment organizations. Andy White is coordinator of the Rights and Resources Institute. He was also one of the panelists who presented the conflict study.
I think one of the biggest findings was just the increase in conflict around land rights across Africa. We suspected that was true. We did not have the numbers to demonstrate the extent of the conflicts and the nature of conflicts. So that was one of the most important findings. Another one was regarding the nature of conflicts, and that is the vast majority are around dislocation, relocation, eviction, rather than compensation. That finding was not a surprise to communities, but it was a surprise to investors and governments.
White said the surprise stems from the conventional thinking of investors who focus on how much money they have to pay those living on the land to get them to sell. However, the study found that many African landowners do not want to give up their land. Women owners in particular value their property and see it as part of their future. As a result, they are forcibly removed from their land rather than being compensated for it, causing conflict.
I think one of the reactions from civil society was that this report gives you more reason for the urgency that they've felt for governments to act and act more quickly. I think there's a general sense from civil society that it is a crisis. Governments are not acting fast enough in passing laws and implementing laws, and that there's a built-up frustration. And there's a real sense that if governments don't get on with it, there will be more conflict.
White emphasized that conflict causes political disruptions, the crossing of borders, refugees, and economic instability. He said African government leaders that attended the event agreed that there is a sense of urgency and land conflict is a problem that will require a consensus of all cross sectors to help solve. He said understanding African communities is the first step in trying to solve African land conflicts.
I've been surprised to see the emergence of some consensus, civil society, private sector leaders, investors, and then the government. One point of consensus, I think, that's emerging is the urgency of mapping customary land use. Most parts of Africa still don't know where communities historically live and how they use the land. Some 80% of the African continent, the landmass, has been customarily owned and used. Roughly 10% is now formally recognized as community land. That indicates a huge gap between the customary use and what's recognized. And so just getting a better sense of where communities are and how they use those lands is step number one.
White highlights there are a number of promising initiatives now underway that are helping communities to map their land, which in turn helps ease transactions with private investors and governments.
For example, we were in Cameroon visiting the Yele community in southern Cameroon. People that we used to call pygmies were supported by the tenure facility to map their customary use of forest. And where they're mapping their rights, it was in a forest area that just several years ago had been given by the government of Cameroon to a rubber plantation. And the government of Cameroon had made the claim or asserted in the contract that the forest was empty. And, of course, it's not empty. And so these mapping tools are helping people. So that's a very big step forward.
White says the mapping of land is a huge step forward in resolving land conflicts because it gives indigenous people a voice, particularly in the negotiation process. African governments and investors attending the event in Dakar support mapping. Open dialogue and the inclusion of women were also topics that emerged as being part of the solution to land conflicts. White said there was a consensus among investors, governments, and local leaders that women should be a part of shaping the future of land rights and business models in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis, VOA News.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.